afternoon, everyone. Where are they? Could we get the music turned down, please? Can you hear me? Thanks. I'm Mike Harold, president of the First Friday Club of Greater Akron, and I'd like to welcome you on behalf of myself and the board to our December 2017 program. Our distinguished speaker for today is Vatican correspondent John Allen. Please silence your cell phones so that we can all enjoy today's program. On your tables, you'll find cards on which you can write down questions for John. After the talk, we have a short announcement break to collect those cards, and then a question and answer session. Now I would like to introduce First Friday Club board member, Steve Brownfield, who will offer our opening prayer.
In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. To you, O Lord, we bring our lives, troubled, broken, or at ease, a sacrificial offering for you to use. Take away our selfishness and teach us to love as you loved. Take away our sense of pride and show us the meaning of humility. Take away our blindness and show us the world through your eyes. Take away our greed and teach us to give as you gave. Show us your ways, teach us your paths, that we may walk with you more closely, our hand in your hand, our feet in your footsteps, from the baby in the stable to eternity. Amen.
Thank you, Steve. At this time, it's my pleasure, and I'm not going to give you any information because you all know him pretty well. He's been coming here for quite a while, and the less I talk, the more he gets to talk. So I'd like to introduce our distinguished speaker, John Allen. Hello, Akron.
Hello, John.
How is everybody today?
Good.
You know, the nature of my job is it's a bit like joining the Navy. It's a great way to see the world. Recently, I was in Lebanon. After that, I was in Trinidad and Tobago. Tomorrow, I am flying to Rome to catch a plane on Monday with a colleague of mine to go to Kenya. So I get around a lot. And once in a while, when I am in these exotic destinations hither and yon, I will be in a bathroom someplace, and I am tempted to break out a felt-tip pen and scrawl on the stall, "For a good time, call the First Friday Club in Akron, Ohio." But I have to say, I just absolutely love being here every year. You know, I was trying to do the math. I actually think last year was my 10th anniversary of speaking at the First Friday Club. So this is, I think, the 11th. Somebody will have to check the archives, but I think that's right. And, you know, I know I say this every year, but it never stops being true, and so I will keep saying it. I just absolutely cherish being here. I think what you people have done in creating and sustaining over such a long arc of time such a really magnificent venue to raise important questions in the life of the church and the life of the society that we live in. And the fact that you always manage to have fun doing it is, ladies and gentlemen, not to be taken for granted. So if you hear nothing else from me here today, I hope you will hear this, and it comes from the very bottom of my heart. Please keep doing this, and please keep asking me to come, because this is just the most cherished event on my annual calendar. Thank you for who you are and what you do. Well, By the way, I see that once again we have some students with us, so here's a kind of job training tip for all of you. If you're going to go into a career that involves a lot of public speaking, you have learned an important lesson today, which is always start by flattering your audience. You do that and you can get away with murder. Okay. Now, having said all of that, ladies and gentlemen, I also have to add that I approach this event today with something of heavy heart, because I am conscious this is the first time, at least for me, that I have been at a First Friday Club in Akron without Sally Reed. And those of you who knew Sally know that she was just one of the most remarkable people that you would ever meet. First of all, there was a grade school nun in Sally someplace, because you always kind of sensed that she was packing a ruler, you know, and if you got too far out of line, you were going to feel it sting. But at the same time, she had a heart as big as Texas. And if you became a part of her family, you were never, ever going to leave it. You know, it's funny. You know, I was talking to Bernie, who was driving me in from the hotel this morning. And I asked him, so how are things going without Sally? And his answer was, well, we've got a great board. It's about 20, 25 people, and we're all really committed. Yet, funnily enough, the 25 of us don't seem to do as much as Sally did all by herself. So she was also just a dynamo of a woman. I miss her. And I miss seeing her smiling face and being able to reconnect with her every year when I come here. That said, I know that Sally is not absent from this room. I know that she is looking down from heaven. One of the ways I know that is that when my wife dropped me off at the Denver airport yesterday to make my way here, her final words to me were, now when you're on that stage tomorrow, do good, because you know Sally is going to be watching. And I can hear her voice in my head and my heart right now saying, would you please shut up about me and get on to the subject at hand. So I'm going to do that. But Sally, I just want to say to you, God love you. And you are here with us today. You are alive in our hearts and our memories, and you will never leave. All right, so I have been asked to speak to you today on the somewhat amorphous subject of Pope Francis and what's happening in the church. Of course, with Pope Francis, there are never any shortage of things to talk about. I am going to try to organize my remarks today under three broad headings. That is, what's happening ad extra, that is, in the Pope's engagement with the wider world. What's happening ad intra, that is, the Pope's leadership of the Church itself, and then what's happening in the Vatican, that is, of course, the environment in which Pope Francis can exercise most direct control, and therefore it's sort of a litmus test of the broader project of reform. And I'm going to try to do all of that in about 30 minutes so that we have plenty of time for conversation. So let's dive right in. Ad extra. A lot of things one could say there, but I actually think over the last few days we have seen a very interesting new chapter of the Pope's role ad extra come into view. The Holy Father, of course, as we speak right now, is in Dhaka, the capital of Bangladesh. He just wrapped up 4 days in Myanmar. This is his third trip to Asia. A very important trip because all sorts of issues are at stake. But when the Pope was in Myanmar, the focus, like a laser beam, of the international media, of human rights groups, of the political and diplomatic community around the world, was how the Pope was going to address the issue of the Rohingya. The Rohingya, of course, are this persecuted Muslim minority in Myanmar. Myanmar is an overwhelmingly Buddhist country, but it has this pocket of Muslims in Rakhine State, which is in the south, and they are known as the Rohingya. They are presently subject to what the United Nations has officially declared a project of ethnic cleansing by the ruling regime in Myanmar, which, although they are in fits and starts trying to make the transition to civilian rule, nevertheless affairs in Myanmar continue to be dominated to a significant extent by the military establishment there, which is very hardline, often in league with radical Buddhist nationalists, hostile to minorities. And the Rohingya have very much been feeling the weight of that. 600,000 of them have been forced to flee to neighboring Bangladesh. More have fled to other neighboring countries, particularly Thailand and Cambodia, because of the oppression that they have felt at the hands of the military. Pope Francis, prior to this trip, had been very outspoken about the Rohingya, and so the question was, when he gets to Myanmar, are we going to see him publicly press the regime in defense of the human rights and the civil liberties of the Rohingya minority? I think most people expected that he would. Pope Francis, after all, over the last 5 years, has created a narrative around himself of being a maverick figure, someone who is not shackled to the conventions of political and diplomatic logic, someone who was willing to speak truth to power, sort of Francis the Fearless, right? And yet, surprisingly, counterintuitively, while he was in Myanmar, Pope Francis did not do any of that. In fact, he never once used the word Rohingya in public. Now that he has gotten to Bangladesh, the climate has changed. Today he held a meeting with 18 Rohingya, members of three refugee families. And he said in that meeting that the presence of God today is called Rohingya. Okay, so he delivered a very powerful message, but he did not do that in Myanmar, which after all, is the source of the problem. Now, what are we to think of that? Was this Francis rolling over? Can we say that Pope Francis blinked? I mean, he's certainly been accused of that. One international human rights group, the Burma Task Force, which agitates on behalf of the rights of the Rohingya, have publicly accused Pope Francis while he was in Myanmar of choosing peace over justice. That is, the accusation is that he chose to placate the regime rather than speak truth to power. So what is that? What is going on here? I would submit to you, no. That is not what is going on here. In fact, what we are seeing is a different aspect of Pope Francis come into view. What we are seeing is Francis, the savvy diplomat, operating, rather than Francis, the sort of feckless pontiff. I think by all accounts, what Pope Francis realized when he was in Myanmar is that were he to publicly provoke the regime, three things almost certainly would have happened. One, he would have made life worse, not better, for the Rohingya minority. He likely would have provoked the government into further crackdowns to prove to the world that it would not be intimidated by an outside interloper. Secondly, he would have made life worse for his own flock in Myanmar, because although Myanmar is an overwhelmingly Buddhist country, and although it has this Buddhist minority, it also has a small Christian minority, including about 700,000 Catholics. Now, up against a national population of 52 million, that may seem like a drop in the bucket, but after all, those 700,000 Catholics are going to have to live with the consequences of whatever the Pope said or did long after he is back in Rome. Francis had to be conscious of the consequences for them as well. And then finally, I think Francis also understood that were he to publicly embarrass or humiliate the regime while he was in Myanmar, that likely would have further entrenched the hardliners and slowed the promise of any sort of transition to democracy. In other words, it would have meant destroying the village in order to save it. And I think what we have learned about Pope Francis on the back of this trip is that he will not only speak out on behalf of persecuted minorities, he will not only speak truth to power, he is not simply capable of being a loose cannon, so to speak, on the global stage, but he is also capable of picking his spots and choosing his fights in very astute and savvy ways. And in that sense, I think it suggests that the process, that the promise of Pope Francis acting as a change agent is actually greater rather than reduced on the back of this visit, because he shows he is capable of leveraging courage with discretion, choosing his moments, threading the needle, so to speak, in ways that few other global leaders are actually able to pull off. I think that is the conclusion to be drawn from the trip that Pope Francis is currently on. And that has implications much broader than the fate of the Rohingya, because let's face it, Pope Francis, in many ways, has become the premier global troubleshooter of our time. There is no troubled part of the world. There is no hot spot on the global map in which and about which three things are not true. One, Pope Francis is paying attention. Two, the people in that place look to him as a sort of privileged hope for getting something done, in some cases the only hope for getting something done, and it really doesn't matter whether that country is of Christian tradition or not. I mean, I am telling you, any place in the world today where there is conflict, where there is anguish, where there is suffering, okay, you go into those places and you ask for opinion, you say, listen, I am someone whose day job is covering the Vatican, covering the Pope. Can you tell me what is going on here? The first thing they are going to say to you is, can you get the Pope to come here? Because we feel that if he came here, it would make a difference. And the third thing that is true is that the global political and diplomatic community is also watching very carefully where Pope Francis goes and what he says while he is there, because they believe it will set the tone for global conversation. Francis has, in a sense, become the indispensable man of global diplomacy and geopolitics today. He is the only figure on the global stage with a sufficient following at the grassroots and sufficient moral credibility at the global level that when he goes someplace, it moves the needle. And the fact that we have watched him over the last 5 days do that artfully and with a degree of savvy, simply rather than running into a spot and potentially making things worse rather than better, I would submit to you is actually a very promising new chapter of the Pope Francis story. And we will have a chance in the months to come to watch that play out in full living color. Pope Francis will be traveling to Chile and Peru in January. Later in 2018, we are fully expecting him to travel to India. He had said he wanted to do it in 2017, and then the Indian government withdrew the invitation at the last minute. He was supposed to be there right now, but he is very ardently hoping that will happen next year. In India, there is this rising tide of Hindu nationalism, which is making life increasingly difficult for minorities, including that country's Christian minority. And then also in 2018, although you can't put this kind of thing on a calendar, but the apple of Pope Francis's eye right now, and it has been for a long time, is traveling to Iraq. He is waiting to get the security clearances to be assured that his safety and the safety of the locals could be guaranteed while he is there. But he is extremely eager to be in that place and to try to promote not only the survival of the Christian community there, but positive change in general. So here is the story, ad extra, ladies and gentlemen. There is no retreat and no surrender from Pope Francis in his boldness at being willing to put his personal credibility on the line to try to help the world's most troubled regions. And what we have learned in Myanmar, I think, is that he can leaven that courage with a degree of diplomatic smarts, diplomatic savvy, that is deeply encouraging about how successful he may be in promoting his campaign for peace and justice around the world. All right, let's shift to the odd intra dimension of things, his role as a change agent inside the Catholic Church. Let me talk specifically about the United States, because that, after all, is where we are. It's our backyard, and naturally, it is the topic of our greatest interest. I think what is fair to say, as we are now at the 5.5-year mark in the Pope Francis experiment here in the United States, is that he has succeeded to a very great degree at changing the internal culture of the American church, but that it remains a work in progress. And that is not true just in the United States, it's true everywhere. If you haven't figured this out already, ladies and gentlemen, there are 1.3 billion Roman Catholics in the world. There are about 70 million of them here in the United States. The notion that we are ever all going to agree on anything is just sheer madness. Okay, and if you're expecting that, you might as well pack up shop and take your religious business at someplace else, because that's just not the Catholic beast. Okay. Let's take the most recent meeting of the U.S. bishops as one index of where we are as a church in America. When the U.S. bishops got together this fall, probably the most closely watched bit of drama in that meeting, because they were supposed to be electing chairs for committees. In one of the committee chairs they needed to elect was the chair of the pro-life committee. That's the committee within the bishop's conference that is responsible for its pro-life advocacy. Now, you had an especially clear contrast in the two candidates who were up for that committee chairmanship. You had Cardinal Blaise Cupich of Chicago, who is sort of your quintessential Pope Francis prelate. He was named to Chicago in a somewhat surprising move by Pope Francis. And he very much embraces what you would think of as the consistent ethic of life approach, which is seeing the church's pro-life advocacy, and particularly its advocacy around abortion, as part of a continuum that also embraces other issues of human dignity, such as compassion for immigrants, such as concern for the poor, such as opposition to the death penalty. And seeing all that as part of what the late Cardinal Joseph Bernardin of Chicago used to refer to as a seamless garment approach to pro-life issues, seeing it all as part of an organic package. The other choice was Archbishop Joseph Nauman of Kansas City, Kansas. who I actually have a great deal of personal fondness for because he is the Archbishop of my alma mater, the University of Kansas in Lawrence, Rock Chalk Jayhawk. And earlier this year, Archbishop Nauman sent me express mail a really cool red and blue KU Jayhawk rosary. So he's all right in my book. Anyway, Archbishop Nauman, a longtime veteran of the Pro-Life Committee, very much would represent the point of view that the struggle against abortion is the primordial moral issue of our time. And while these other things, which are typically mentioned as part of that seamless garment, while they are undeniably important, they are not as compelling as the struggle against abortion, which deserves a kind of moral pride of place. Okay? And if we would think of the consistent ethic of life approach as more the Pope Francis approach, and the priority on abortion as more the sort of John Paul II and Benedict approach, now those are very loose and inexact labels, but they capture something, okay? What happened when the bishops voted? Basically, Archbishop Nauman won a very narrow victory. It was the most contested vote at the conference this year. It was, I believe the final tally was 92 to 86, but it was in there someplace. Okay, what do we take away from that? Well, what we take away from that is that if you had run that vote 5 years ago, when the Pope Francis era was just beginning, I suspect Nauman would have won in a landslide. And if we run the clock forward, 3 years from now, presuming that Pope Francis is still appointing bishops, and you were to run the same election, I suspect that Supich would win fairly comfortably. Okay. In other words, what it tells us is that while the pre-existing center of gravity in the bishops' conference certainly has not gone away, I think what you could think of as the Pope Francis constituency in the bishops' conference is growing. And that, of course, should be no surprise because Francis has been naming those bishops for the last 5 years. And the longer Pope Francis goes on, he's going to turn 81 on December 17th. But ladies and gentlemen, take it from me, I watched this man up close and personal. There is absolutely no indication that he is slowing down. There is absolutely no indication of any kind of health crisis. I think this easily could, he easily could continue with full vigor for another 5 years, barring the unforeseen, at a minimum. And so then we'll see where we are. But the longer the Pope Francis continues to be naming bishops around the world and in the United States, I think the more the winds are going to shift in that direction. Broader conclusion, however, I think, is that this is never going to be a uniformly Pope Francis conference, just as it never was a uniformly John Paul or Benedict XVI conference. There will always be that diversity within it. And the question is, are we able to manage that diversity constructively or can't we? Okay. And that will be true across a wide variety of other issues. I mean, not simply how we understand our social teaching. Pope Francis, for instance, recently returned a great deal of the control over translation of liturgical texts, that is, the words we use at Mass and the other rituals of the Church. He took that away from the Vatican and gave it back to the local bishops' conferences. So in terms of how the Mass sounds in the English language, or for that matter in Spanish or other languages that are used here in the United States, the action going forward will no longer be in Rome, it will be with our bishops. Now, it may not surprise you to know that bishops have somewhat different ideas on that front. And in principle, that is very healthy. I mean, Catholicism is supposed to be a both-and tradition, not an either-or. Okay, so all of those points of view have a kind of seat at the table. That's how it's supposed to work. But the question, again, is can we manage those differences in a kind of spirit of common cause and partnership, Or are we going to drain all of our energies away in internal infighting and shouting at one another? I would like to suggest, apropos of that, that a very healthy development for the church in the United States, from the bishops on down, would be if we would all take a six-month Twitter break. Yeah, and just stop thinking that the right way to be Catholic in the early 21st century is to outsnark people with whom you disagree in 144 characters. I think that would be a really promising. I'm not holding my breath, but I think it would be healthy. But in any event, I guess the diagnosis on Pope Francis at the 5-year mark ad intra. Is that he is succeeding steadily in promoting an internal climate in the church that reflects his own vision, but that is never going to be uniform, that is never going to be complete. We are never going to be moving entirely in lockstep because that simply is not the nature of the Catholic Church. Okay? Finally, Francis and the Vatican. When Francis was elected in March 2013, most of the cardinals who voted for him thought they were, in part, voting for a reformer. And when you asked them what they meant by reform, you know, it wasn't just lighting the world on fire, right? You know, it wasn't just changing the public face of the church, although I think they are delighted to see all of that. But what they meant by reform, in large part, was somebody who was going to clean up the Vatican, get it under control, particularly on two of the most thorny and chronic sources of scandal outside of the Vatican, or in the Vatican and therefore for the outside world, which are, of course, the clerical sexual abuse scandals in the church, and then the Vatican's chronic problem with money management, the perennial financial scandals that erupt from time to time in the Holy See. And I think at the 5-year mark, what we have to say, if that's what we mean by Francis as a reformer, then I think we have to say at the 5-year mark, the verdict remains decidedly mixed. It is true, of course, that Pope Francis has said all the right things when it comes to the sex abuse scandals. He has publicly and repeatedly pledged his support for a policy of zero tolerance. He has pledged greater accountability, particularly for people in leadership in the church who mismanage abuse accusations, who drop the ball, who try to cover things up. Francis has said there will be no daddy's boys on his watch. That is, nobody with impunity or invulnerability. And there have been instances in which he has taken critically important steps forward, where he's put his money where his mouth is. On the other hand, advocates for survivors of clerical abuse and people who watch these issues carefully will also tell you that there have been incidents in which things have not appeared to break in the right direction, in which there are worrying signs of business as usual. For instance, Pope Francis appointed a new bishop in Chile, Bishop Juan Manuel Barros, a couple of years ago, who, it turns out, had been an apologist for that country's most notorious pedophile priest, its most egregious abuser, and despite howls of public protest, despite repeatedly being advised it would be wise to rethink that appointment, Pope Francis has stubbornly refused to address it. Barros remains in power, and of course, if you live in Chile, where Pope Francis is heading in January, that has raised real questions about the seriousness of the Vatican's commitment to reform. You may also remember that there was a story from about a year and a half ago when the Vatican's nuncio, that is the Pope's ambassador in the Dominican Republic, a guy by the name of Archbishop Joseph Wenzelowski, was publicly accused of abuse in the Dominican Republic. He was brought back to Rome with vows that he was going to be investigated and tried Unfortunately, Archbishop Wesolowski died before that could actually happen, so that, unfortunately, does not serve as proof of anything in terms of how committed the Holy See actually is to reform. We now have a new test case. There was an official at the Vatican Embassy in Washington who was detained by Canadian authorities trying to re-enter the country on suspicions that there was child pornography on his laptop. Guy's name is Monsignor Carlo Capella. He has been recalled to Rome, so he is currently in Rome. Once again, the Vatican has insisted that there will be a thorough investigation, and if grounds are discovered to prosecute Capella, that there will be a trial and that he will be held accountable. Now, in the meantime, Canada has issued its own arrest warrant for Monsignor Capella. The Vatican has also insisted that once they're done, they will fully cooperate with the demands of criminal justice in Canada. So keep your eyes peeled, because this is, I think, a critically important test case. If those things happen, if we see a credible and transparent investigation and prosecution of Capella in the Holy See, and after that, if we see full cooperation with Canada's request for extradition, then perhaps we can say that a new era of accountability has arrived, but we cannot say that today. Okay, we are going to have to see how that plays out. In terms of the financial reform of the Vatican, it is very much the same story. When Francis arrived, there were promises and vows of a new era of transparency and accountability. Francis created three new organisms, a council for the economy. The first time any decision-making body in the Vatican was ever composed both of cardinals and also competent and qualified lay financial experts from around the world, in which laity were full equals. Their votes count for every bit as much as the cardinals on that body. And then he created a new secretariat for the economy inside the Vatican itself that was supposed to be the tip of the spear for reform. And he hired a new independent auditor general that was supposed to keep everybody else honest. Where are we today? Well, the Secretariat for the Economy is basically adrift. It's dead in the water because the cardinal Francis appointed to head it, Australian Cardinal George Pell, isn't in Rome. He is back in Australia trying to fight off charges of what the Australians call historical sexual abuse. So there is no leadership of Francis's new reform agency. The independent auditor general is also gone from the scene. In September, the Vatican put out a cryptic statement saying that they and this auditor general, an Italian financier by the name of Libero Maloney, had parted company, even though he was only 3 years into what was supposed to be a five-year term. And from September to today, we still have no explanation of why that happened. Well, I should say, we have no official explanation. I mean, this is Italy we're talking about, where the Italians have never seen a conspiracy theory they aren't prepared to believe. So there are actually 1,000 theories out there about what really happened, but none of them you can really hang your hat on. And just 2 days ago, the number two official in the Vatican Bank, another Italian by the name of Claudio Mattanetti, was also unceremoniously shown the door. The Vatican put out another cryptic statement saying that he had been released from his responsibilities. But once again, there's no explanation beyond that. We don't know why that happened. Now, you know, in the last 2 days, I have been getting WhatsApps and emails and phone calls from my sources in Rome, some of whom are telling me that this is actually a step forward for reform. This is the Vatican weeding out the bad actors from the system, and others who will swear until they're blue in the face that Mattanetti actually is a good guy, and this is a case of the old guard putting together what the Italians call a montatura. Basically, it means a frame job. You know, I mean, they're arguing that Mattanetti has been framed, and this is actually the bad guys, you know, reasserting their grip on power. Which of those is true? I have no earthly idea. Okay, and I know I'm paid to know this stuff. I apologize for failing you, but I am telling you, I honest to God do not know. And the reason I don't know is because the Vatican in these instances has chosen to handle these things behind closed doors rather than in full public view. And the face value conclusion there is whatever theory you want to believe, we were told that one of the hallmarks of the new era was going to be transparency. And so far, folks, I have to say that if this is transparency, I would hate to see obscurity. Okay. And so, what does all that mean? Well, I think what it means is that Francis still has some boxes to check on the to-do list. Okay. And that should not surprise us. Okay, you know, the Catholic Church is a big, complicated institution. And as a microcosm, the Vatican is an infinitely complicated and slow-moving part of that picture. I think it is unreal to expect to have expected that Francis was going to bring a new heaven and a new earth within the first 5 years of his mandate. Besides which, I also think that every pope at some point, every one of the modern popes anyway, reaches a kind of critical Rubicon in his papacy where he has to face the decision, which is, am I going to spend all of my waking energies for the rest of my papacy trying to fix the Vatican? Am I going to engage the broader pressing issues in the church, in the world, which are clamoring for my attention? That doesn't mean forgetting about the Vatican, but it also means not devoting all of your time and treasure to it. I think, quite honestly, Pope Francis may have reached that moment a while ago. But that doesn't mean that this doesn't remain critically important, because if the Vatican remains a source of scandal and heartache, if it continues to occasionally generate these scandals that sort of undercut not only the Pope's credibility, but the Church's standing in the eye of the wider world, then that is a kind of obstacle to evangelization and to change that does have to be addressed. And what I can tell you is that the work of addressing it remains unfinished. Okay? So I think that's the story. Remarkable accomplishment at the odd extra level. Remarkable but inconsistent process at the odd intra level. And a kind of grade of incomplete when we come to the Vatican for Pope Francis. Fortunately, what we know about Pope Francis is that that is the story for today. Won't necessarily be the story for tomorrow. Because Pope Francis, ladies and gentlemen, is the Energizer Bunny of popes. Okay, the man simply has no off switch. Okay. Final thought before we start the questions, and I'll try to make this quick. The picture I have just painted for you is in some ways of a turbulent church, right? A church that is trapped between differing visions, that is locked in lots of debates about where Pope Francis is taking us, and that has a lot of work to do. Now, in facing all of those challenges, we are also quite often a church that is divided. Because I'm going to guess that if we really got into it, there's probably more than one opinion in this room about what Pope Francis, you know, should and should not be doing. And if we expand that out to all those 1.3 billion Catholics around the world, then think about that. You know, think about the challenges of trying to manage all of that riotous complexity. Now, in principle, that diversity ought to be a healthy thing, right? It keeps us alive. It keeps us fresh. It's what makes us a church and not a sect. However, There is also the danger that diversity can siphon off all of our energies into internal debates and rivalries and differing camps, and prevent us from ever approaching anything in a spirit of common cause. So, how do we avoid that danger? Well, I don't have a magic bullet solution, but I will tell you this. My experience tells me that one essential element of the solution is a good sense of humor. You know, if we can't laugh at ourselves once in a while, we are going to spend all of our time fighting down heartburn. You know, we're going to be crying rather than laughing. And that's probably not a prescription for doing anything good. So I want to leave you with this thought. The good news here is you can find a lively sense of humor in the Catholic Church, even in the most unexpected places. Okay? Now, some of you may have heard this story before. If you have, please don't ruin it for everyone else. Here's the thing. In the abstract, how many people in this room would think of Pope Benedict XVI as like the Jimmy Fallon of the Catholic Church? All right, just not a guy you would think of as like the king of the one-liners, right? Refined and erudite and cerebral, right? But, you know, a barrel of laughs all of the time? Probably not, right? Here's the story. In 2015, when Benedict was elected to the papacy, I wrote one of these Insta books, right? The inside story of the conclave and all of that. And when it came out, or 2005, sorry, not 2015, 2005. And when the book came out, I dedicated a copy to Pope Benedict. And I gave it to his spokesman. And then I forgot about it because it never really occurred to me that the Pope would actually read it. 2 months later, I am back in the United States kind of for summer vacation with my wife Shannon. We're out visiting my grandma. We recently lost her, but she was still alive and kicking back then, out in rural western Kansas, a place called Hill City, which is my candidate for the worst place name in America because there is no hill and there is no city. Okay. Anyway, there we are in Graham County, Kansas, and my phone rings and it's the papal spokesperson. At the time, it was still Joaquin Navarro-Valls, saying, "Hey, John, I am at breakfast. Well, I'm up north in Italy. The Pope is on vacation, too. They were in a place called Val d'Aosta near the border with Switzerland. And he says, wanted to let you know that the Holy Father came down this morning to breakfast with your book in his hands. And he asked me to deliver a personal message to you." I don't know if you're like me, but if you have just been told that the Pope has a personal, private reaction to something you wrote about him, I would want to make sure that your tray table is in a full, upright, and locked position, right? Because the skies may get a little bumpy. But anyway, so I said to Navarro-Valls, "That's great. You know, what's the message?" Now, to understand this, you have to know that this book was divided into three parts. Okay, so the first part were the last days of John Paul II, right, setting the scene for the conclave. The middle part was the inside story of the conclave, how Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger had been elected in 5 ballots. And then the last part were my projections for where his papacy was going to go. Okay. So Navarro-Valls says, "The Holy Father's message was, please thank Herr Dr. Allen for having written this book, especially the last part about the future of my papacy, because it has saved me the trouble of thinking about it for myself." I like to think he was kidding. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, I would say on this, as on so many other matters, if we can take our cues from the Holy Father, if we can take a clear-eyed, unflinching, realistic look at the realities of our situation and the challenges facing us, But if we can do that with a twinkle in our eye, rather than bile in our spleen and rage in our hearts, I would submit to you that is a winning strategy for Catholic life in the early 21st century, every day of the week and twice on Sunday. Thank you. God bless you. God bless the First Friday Club of Akron, Ohio, and Sally Reed in heaven. Baby, this one was for you.
You can have a seat for a little while. Let's go. Let's do it.
Well, thank you again, John, for all those insights and news that we wanted to know about. So, our next First Friday Luncheon will be here at Tangier on Friday, January 5th, 2018, with a presentation by Sister Catherine Walsh, who will share with us the story of the Catholic Worker Movement and Akron's Catholic Worker House. If you are one of the folks listening to this on a podcast at our website, we invite you to join us in person. You can make reservations by sending a check to the First Friday Club, 795 Russell Avenue, Akron 44307. You can call our phone number, 330-535-7668 each month, or online on our website using Eventbrite. If you sign up for a month on a monthly basis, let us know by Tuesday before the Friday talk. Please consider signing up for a yearly, 6-month, or multiple presentation. Brochures for next year's program are on the registration table in the hallway and are available for subscriptions. Also, if you are a past subscriber, you will be receiving this subscription mailing shortly. You can hear a podcast of the previous speakers by logging into our website. Please consider recommending our programs to a friend and also join us on Facebook. If you're not on our mailing list, take time to fill out one of the information cards on the table. I'd like to have some recognitions. I'd first like first-time attendees to either wave or stand up so we can see who's a first-timer. Please welcome those folks. Today we're fortunate to have students from Our Lady of the Elms, St. Vincent St. Mary, and Walsh Jesuit High Schools. Could those young people please stand? We also have students from St. Mary and St. Sebastian Elementary Schools. Would those folks please stand? And I'd also like to recognize the board members of the First Friday Club. Please stand. Now I'd like to introduce Vice President Bernie Rochford, who will direct our questions and answers. Nobody collected questions. Anybody have any?
John's.
Oh, there's some up there.
While they're collecting questions, you mentioned a question you get asked all the time that I don't think in the 10 years prior that's been asked. How do we get the Pope here?
I think the best idea would be to start a civil war here in Akron. He loves going to hot spots, so if there's something bubbling out there. In all seriousness, folks, my answer is don't hold your breath. Pope Francis has come to the United States once, and even that was kind of an accident. The World Day of Families was taking place here. In his mind, it was a global event that just happened to be taking place in Philadelphia. This is a pope of the peripheries. If you look at it, he has not made a state visit to a single European nation over 5 years. He's going to Portugal this year, but that's only because of the Fatima anniversary, right? Look at where he's going this year, where he's been in the past. I think it's a much greater chance that Pope Francis is going to be in the Pacific island of Tonga for instance, then he is going to make a point out of making another visit to a first world nation. Now, listen, if he asked me, I mean, you know, my philosophy for a good time, call Akron, okay? So wouldn't it be great if he and I could do a tag team thing here next year? I mean, I'm all for it, but I'm just saying, don't count on it.
I think we could probably get E.J. Thomas if that happens. So we can,
I think you could get anybody you wanted if that happened.
What do you make of the dust-up between Pope Francis and a prominent cardinal over the reform of the post-Vatican II liturgy?
Well, there's actually more than one prominent cardinal, but I think I know who we mean here. Listen, there have been dusts up with Francis and some of his cardinals over all kinds of things, right? I mean, it's not just the liturgy. I mean, if we look at Amoris Laetitia, for instance, Pope Francis's groundbreaking document on the family, and its provision for creating circumstances under which divorced and civilly remarried Catholics could return to the sacraments, which is a shift in previous church policy. There were a number of prominent cardinals who criticized him for that, too. Newsflash, there were prominent cardinals who criticized Pope Benedict for stuff, too. There were prominent cardinals who criticized Pope John Paul for stuff. There were prominent cardinals who criticized Pope Paul VI for stuff. And for that matter, if you know your New Testament, there was a prominent apostle who criticized Peter for some stuff. Okay? You know, this is the Catholic Church. As the late Francis George, Cardinal Francis George of Chicago, once said, in the Catholic Church, absolutely everything has happened at least once. And most of it has happened a lot. And this falls clearly into the category of a lot. But I will tell you this, I don't think that the opposition of Pope Francis is any more dramatic or pronounced than opposition to previous popes. I think the difference is that in a social media age, it's amplified. Okay, because you know, news stories can go viral today in nanoseconds in a way that previously wasn't the case. So there's a megaphone for absolutely everything. I think, therefore, we get an exaggerated sense of the degree of opposition to Francis or to any particular pope. I mean, you know, but look at the poll numbers. I mean, you know, we're 5 years into the Pope Francis papacy, and what we know is that he has an over 80% approval rating among Americans generally, and he has over a 90% approval rating among American Catholics. So is there opposition? Sure. You know, does it represent majority sentiment? Clearly not. Just as was true of previous popes. So, yeah, listen, you know, there are going to be dust-ups. There are going to be arguments. You know, Pope Francis is shaking things up, and that is going to generate friction. It is built into the system. And make no mistake, that friction is healthy. You know, I say again, Catholicism is a both and tradition. You know, as Pope John the 23rd used to say, as Pope, you have to listen both to those with their foot on the gas and also those with their foot in the brake. Okay, because each of them they're trying to defend something valuable. The trick is to try to manage those tensions constructively. Okay, and so rather than seeing this as a war of all against all, in which Francis needs to vanquish his foes as quickly as possible, or, depending on where you are, those foes need to run him out of town on a rail as quickly as possible. I think the trick is to see all of this, see the value of what Francis is trying to do for the church, while also seeing the value of those who were yelling, slow down, be careful, because they both have a point. And in that alchemy, you know, bringing about the kind of balance which has always been the genetic genius of the Catholic Church and which is our challenge in this time as well.
What do you think we can expect in 2018 with a synod on young people? Is it a big deal or not really?
Well, you know, here's the thing. You know, for my sins, I have covered something like 15 synods of bishops over the years, which are these big hootenannies they stage in Rome every 2 or 3 years, where they bring about 300 bishops from around the world together to discuss some issue. Listen, generally speaking, riveting theater a synod of bishops is not. Okay? I've often thought that they could almost bottle and market these things as a cure for insomnia. Because, you spend eight hours a day at a synod of bishops, and let me tell you are ready for a nap, generally. Now, the last couple synods we saw weren't really like that. Francis's synods on the family in 2014 and 2015 were kind of electric because, there was a real clash between substantive issues, and for the most part, it was all unfolding in full public view. I guess I would caution you, don't expect that this time around. My personal feeling is that most of the issues that are going to be discussed at this synod are going to be largely non-controversial. I mean, who's going to argue that we need to do a better job of reaching out to young people, or, we need to do a better job of working with young married couples and so on? There may be some sparks along the way. I personally am expecting that somebody from some part of the Catholic world probably will raise the issue of married priests, because vocation is part of the mix at this synod. I would expect that will come up, and it will be hashed out, and you will hear differing views. I wouldn't expect it to be resolved at the synod, but I do expect it will be in the air. But for the most part, I don't think there's going to be a lot of scintillating news headlines. That's it. Okay. My experience of covering all of these synods is that whether they actually accomplish anything or not, whether they're particularly compelling drama or not, there is value to the experience. And I think there is special value for our bishops from the United States who take part. Because if we're going to be honest with ourselves as Americans, I think here's a truth we probably have to confront. We have so many virtues as a culture. People from around the world don't literally put their lives on the line to get here for no reason. Okay? As President Reagan used to remind us, in so many ways, we are that shining city on a hill. That said, we also have some national defects. Okay? One of them often is a degree of insularity, myopia. Right? We Americans often don't know much about the rest of the world. Okay? We produce the books the rest of the world reads. We produce the TV the rest of the world watches. We produce the music that the rest of the world listens to. We are not great at consuming culture from the rest of the world. I'm not going to embarrass anybody in this room in a show of hands asking if you can even find the place Pope Francis is right now on a map. Okay, although that would be a good question for our high school students, geography. Do you actually know where Dhaka, Bangladesh is? But that's the point. That tends to be a blind spot for us. Right? And so we tend to assume that the conversations we're having in the United States are the same conversations the rest of the world is having. We tend to assume that our priorities are their priorities. We tend to assume that our categories are their categories. Ladies and gentlemen, it just ain't so. Okay? Now, the virtue of these synods is that if you take part in one of them, what you get, regardless of the outcome, you are there for 3 weeks with bishops and priests and nuns and lay leaders from Africa and from Asia and from Latin America and from Oceania. It is a graduate seminar in the global realities of the church. And I will tell you, over 20 years of covering the American bishops, I note a distinct difference between those of our bishops who have participated in one of these synods and those who haven't. Those who have been there just instinctively think in a more global key, right? You raise some issue in the life of the American church, and they are much more inclined to say, well, but we have to think about how that's going to play out in Africa, for instance, or, we have to be aware of how that is going to play out in Asia. They have a much greater sense of the whole. So, short answer to your question, am I expecting drama from this synod? Not really. Does that mean I think it's a bad idea? Not at all. Because here's the reality about Catholicism in the 21st century, folks. If you're going to think about the church, your choices are, you either think globally or you think dysfunctionally. Okay, those are the options that are on the menu. Let me run the numbers again. 70 million Catholics in the United States, 1.3 billion in the world. Takeaway, we are just about 6.5% of the world's Catholic population. Put another way, 94% of the Catholics in the world, in important census, ain't like us. And if we're going to understand Catholicism in our time, we have to get our minds around that. And to the extent a synod of bishops helps drive that home for our leaders, I think it's worth doing.
I just want to thank John again. Michael, come up. And as Mike's coming up, we did forget one school who's not here for some reason.
For a good reason, right?
They had some game last night. Congratulations to Archbishop Hovind High School for quite a decisive victory.
Yeah, I wanted to say something, but I didn't want to be accused of being partisan, so I didn't mention it. Again, we want to thank John. Wish we had had a little more time for questions, because I'm sure there are some good ones there. It's my pleasure now to introduce longtime friend of the First Friday Club, Ellen Cafori, who will lead us in our closing prayer.
Let us pray. Advent God, we journey with you to Bethlehem's stable and a newborn king. Ears attuned to the song of angels, eyes alert for Bethlehem's star. Forgive us if on our journey we are distracted by the tempting offers of this world. Keep our hearts aflame with the hope of Christmas and the promise of a Savior. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you, Ellen. But thank everybody for coming. We look forward to seeing some of you here next month on January 5th. And Will Yoho, if you're here, I need to talk to you.
That doesn't sound good.
Take care. Safe travels.